This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hello, I'm Alana Gordon. I'm a reporter at The World covering global health. Here at The World, we've been holding a regular series of coronavirus conversations, presented jointly with The Forum at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. We've been taking your questions to the experts. The whole discussion series is featured on our Facebook page, but we wanted to share what we think are really valuable conversations with you right here in The World's podcast feed. Recently, we convened a bigger forum about racism, hate, and discrimination against Asian Americans, how to combat it, and how it intersects with the global pandemic. The panel had four guests. They were Russell Jung, professor of Asian American Studies at San Francisco State University and co-founder of Stop AAPI Hate, Paul Watanabe, director of the Institute for Asian American Studies and professor of political science at the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Massachusetts in Boston, Juliet Choi, president and CEO of the Asian and Pacific Islander American Health Forum, and Howard Koh, the Harvey V. Feinberg professor of the practice of public health leadership at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and the Harvard Kennedy School. From the beginning, Asian Americans have been treated as other. Yet the long history of violence and discrimination against Asian Americans, as well as the diverse stories and histories of Asian Americans, are often invisible and overlooked. Now the coronavirus pandemic has intensified hate and racism against Asian Americans. Former President Trump called the coronavirus the China virus and Wuhan flu in public remarks. Language matters, it's had an impact. People have experienced being spat on, yelled at, called slurs, and horrific examples like the recent killings in Atlanta have made hate and racism more visible. During this forum, we're going to talk about how more than 3,700 anti-Asian incidents, many directed towards women, were reported in the last 12 months. We'll also have an opportunity to take a deeper look at this array of violence, its impact on Asian Americans and on society as a whole, and most importantly, how to combat it, equally importantly. So kicking things off, I want to play a short excerpt of a radio story from my show, The World, from PRX, on how communities are responding. In Chinatown, in Oakland, California, many older community members have been afraid to leave their homes. Reporter Heidi Shin brings us this story of a volunteer who's part of the area's community ambassador program.
Sakon Lasafangtang wants people to notice him, to ask him for help.
Oh, they know it's me because I'm big and bald. I'm like almost 6 foot, you know, with glasses on. You know, when they see me, I stand out.
He's taking me on a tour of Oakland's Chinatown by phone. He shows me a spot where a 91-year-old man was shoved to the ground just a few weeks ago.
This is Harrison and 8th, so this is where it happened.
Sakon regrets he wasn't there. He thinks he could have made a difference.
You know, none of this attack ever happened when I'm working in Chinatown. It's always when I leave, I can't believe it. Who would want to attack, you know, elderly people?
So kicking things off, Russell, as we just heard, this group walks the streets of Chinatown in Oakland to care for the neighborhood and help residents feel safe. Last year in March of 2020, just as the impact of the pandemic was starting to be felt in the US, you started the Stop AAPI Hate Reporting Center. Why did you start this project and what have you been finding?
Thanks, Alana. Well, as you said, Asian Americans have a long history in the US. And a major part of that long history is that whenever a pandemic came from Asia, Asians were blamed for that disease, they were met with violence, and they were met with racist policies. So we knew at Stop AAPI Hate, we had to document what was happening in order to put it on the agenda of government to make it known by media. And so we created this website. And if we could put up the slides, I'll show you the kind of data we've been receiving. Immediately, you know, we talked about President Trump then began to use the term Chinese virus, and it was deadly because it racialized the virus. It made a biological virus Chinese, and it stigmatized the people so that Chinese were the disease carriers. And immediately, again, Asians were targeted, and the fear and the anger directed towards Asian Americans is palpable. You could see it in our incidents and how people are reporting it. If you look at this chart, not everything is a hate crime, but the racism sort of can be categorized in four different ways. On the bottom, civil rights violations make up 8% of the cases for being mistreated at the workplace, facing denial of ride shares. Online harassment is really widespread. I think most Asian Americans, especially youth, face indirect racisms in that they see racist posts, memes, trolling daily. Microaggressions on the top, which include verbal harassment and avoidance, make up the bulk of the incidents, but they're not necessarily micro. Again, they're racially traumatizing. People are, like you said, are getting yelled at, often in gang bullying situations. They're having slurs and racial epithets thrown at them. One out of five Stop AAPI Hate respondents now display signs of racial trauma. That's long-term elevated symptoms of depression, anxiety, avoidance, and hypervigilance. That's the hallmark of trauma, hypervigilance and avoidance. The last category is physical assault. We were coughed and spat upon so often that we just created a special category for it where people could just check off, someone coughed on me. My wife was running on a trail, someone just deliberately blocked her path and coughed into her face. So again, this is across the nation. People ask, how do you know there's a rise in racism? Well, people weren't spitting on their fellow humans in 2019. Physical assaults make up 11%, and those are the hate crimes for which people could receive higher penalties if racial bias is discerned. I just want to wrap up and say, you know, what's sad is that vulnerable populations are being targeted. Women are harassed twice as much as men. And as we've seen, especially in the news, elderly are attacked more often, especially have higher rates of physical assault than the rest of the Asian American population. And youth are also attacked in disproportionate numbers.
It's a really powerful visual to see unpacking what's happening right now. And of course, I look forward to digging in more with all of you. I want to move to Paul. I wonder, you know, we're seeing this escalation in a pandemic, but could you help us put today's climate in historical context?
Well, thank you, Alana, and thank you to Russell and Howard and Juliet for this opportunity to join on this important topic. Let me say that I've been giving these remarks in response to some action or crisis for over 40 years that's impacted the Asian American community. You can fill in the blank. It can be the murder of Vincent Chin. It could be the Wen Ho Lee scandal. It could be South Asian treatment after 9/11. It could be the COVID-19 pandemic. It could be Atlanta. It could be Indianapolis, where we shouldn't forget that half of the victims at the FedEx shooting were people of Asian descent. If I were alive in 1882 or 1924 or 1942, I think I'd be giving the same talk as well. And that is to say to explain the discrimination against Asian Americans. Now, in the mid-19th century, when Asian Americans were arriving for the first time, there was a great deal of ignorance about Asian Americans. But here today, when Asian Americans are 300 times greater than they were in the mid-19th century, I think ignorance still prevails about our knowledge about the Asian American community. And this is despite the fact that now 20 million people in the United States trace their ancestry to Asia, and that we are the fastest growing racial group in the United States. We're a community of great diversity, Asian ethnic groups. There are about 50 of us now. There's no single Asian American group. It's made up of 50 different Asian ethnicities. And there's great socioeconomic diversity as well in terms of income, in terms of poverty, educational attainment, health status, as we're going to see. In all of these respects, we're an undifferentiated monolithic and certainly not a simple model minority. And we've been in the United States, as I point out, for over 200 years. And yet, despite these numbers and longevity, Asian Americans, I think, have been largely invisible. We have been hidden in plain sight. We have been seen, but not really seen. And the consequences of this is that when a group is invisible, they are often marginalized. They are often subject to prejudice. They're often subject to vulnerability to stereotypes. In the racial construction of Asian Americans, I think there have been some dominant racializations. And one of them is the notion of Asian Americans as perpetual foreigners. And this has had an impact on our individual lives as Asian Americans, but it's had historical manifestations in much more powerful ways in terms of the legal and political realities of Asian Americans. Asian Americans are the group that since it's coming here to the United States were in aliens and eligible for citizenship. We could come here as immigrants, but could not become citizens. Exclusion began in 1882 for the first time with Chinese Americans. For the first time, we told a group of people in the United States, you cannot come because of the color of your skin or where you're coming from. That began in 1882 and was expanded to all Asians in 1924. In World War II, my parents and my family were placed in America's concentration camps for looking like the enemy, for being Japanese Americans. And on, it can be the treatment, as I suggest, South Asians after 9/11, the COVID crisis, as pointed out by Russell. And the question is, why is this so pernicious? Why is a perpetual foreigner notion, the notion that no matter how long we have been here in the United States, in some way Asian Americans are assumed to be tied to the country from which their ancestors came? It combines two powerful forces. It combines racism and it combines nativism. And as Russell has pointed out, because of the disproportionate attacks on women, it combines sexism. So from exclusion to incarceration to the violence described by Russell, the threads have been there together, and it is clear that they're going to continue, and we hope that we can stop it now. Thank you very much.
Really powerful remarks to kick off this discussion. I want to move to Juliet. Building on that, are there signs that these hate incidents are receiving some more visibility and attention at the highest levels? I mean, last week, the Senate passed the COVID-19 Hate Crimes Act. Biden highlighted this, the importance of this week in his address to Congress. So what exactly is in this legislation, and what do you see as the most important next steps?
Yeah, thank you, Alana. And thank you so much for everyone who's joining us for this conversation. I think the need to have these kinds of conversations more frequently, more regularly, is really going to help to increase the country's understanding of these situations and incidences of hate that our communities have experienced. As Paul very elegantly highlighted, this is not a new occurrence. This is something that has been happening in our country historically over the years. So again, I wanna thank you and thank the audience for joining us. With regard to the legislation, I want to address that very, very briefly. I think, you know, I am one of those who lives in Washington, D.C. And there is the critique that, you know, does Washington, D.C. get anything done? The fact that the Senate, in a bipartisan fashion, with a vote of 94-1 in the Senate, overwhelmingly in a bipartisan fashion, passed the hate crimes legislation is a remarkable statement. I think it's a remarkable chapter now for our American history. Now, the next shoe I am waiting to see drop is how quickly will the House act? How quickly will it act? And how strong will the bipartisan support be with this historical legislation? We are all Americans, and this legislation, if you will, as one of those recovering attorneys, I do want to say, as a form of civil rights legislation, let's get it right for our fellow Americans. So I am eager to see how the House reacts and what the vote ultimately ends up looking like. That's the legislation. In terms of where we are, and if we can take a step back, the fact that President Biden, together with Vice President Harris, starting with day one, declared through a presidential memorandum that xenophobia is not acceptable in our country, that it is un-American. You don't have to be Asian American, Native Hawaiian, or Pacific Islander to support that proposition. As all Americans, we should support the proposition that xenophobia is not acceptable in our country and has no place in our American society. I also do want to declare, as Paul highlighted and Russell, with the not just the numbers, but also the narrative, words matter. My friends have heard me say this. Words absolutely matter. If we leverage words to uplift one another as fellow Americans, we will take greater care of one another. But I will also underscore that the last 4 years of an anti-immigrant agenda combined with the last administration's treatment of, rather than dealing with COVID and talking about COVID in the context of a global pandemic, chose to, in a very, very hurtful way, to cast this against the Asian American Pacific Islander community. I think as advocates, I can very, very clearly say with confidence that, again, words matter, bad words should not be accepted, and we need to hold our leaders accountable. Lastly, I want to highlight allyship matters. I think in this surge, as Paul highlighted with the history of our country, this notion of hate incidences, this notion of invisibility, this false foundation of describing our community as a model minority group, let's go ahead and dispense with that. And I think where we are as a country today, there is growing heightened awareness that we absolutely need to dispel with this phraseology of model minority myth, with allyship, whether it's centering Black lives, uplifting our Native American brothers and sisters, uplifting our sisters and brothers and minority religious communities, like our Sikh and Muslim brothers and sisters. Right now, very much, I am an optimist at heart, and this is where allyship matters. And I am optimistic. It's going to take us a lot of work, but we must and we will make progress so that we eliminate this notion of invisibility for our community, and that we can uplift the Asian American, Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander community writ large.
Thank you so much, Juliet. I want to now move to Howard. And it has to do with how this all connects with, intersects with health. I wanted to see if you could talk about and kick things off about what we know, and maybe more importantly, what we don't know about how COVID-19, the pandemic, has affected the health of people in the AAPI community.
Well, first, Alana, it's always great to work with you, and thank you for moderating once again. And I'm so honored to join this respected panel today. So let's start by understanding how prejudice and discrimination threaten any hint of health equity. When Asian Americans are being harassed and assaulted and hear comments like, "Go back to where you came from," how do you respond if you came from America? We have to begin by understanding that Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, AAPI for short, have contributed to this country's social fabric for centuries, as Paul has described. Yet we are regularly viewed as not Americans, as them, not us, as being on the margins, not in the mainstream, and regularly considered foreigners in our own country. So this affects AAPI emotional well-being, and the risks have been described by Russell, including stress, anxiety, depression, and other outcomes. And remember, this population is already less likely than white populations to report a need for mental health services, especially those with low English proficiency and foreign-born status. And some preliminary studies also associate AAPI discrimination with outcomes such as pain, headache, or even exacerbation of heart and lung conditions. So how do we reverse all this? We have to start by confronting all the assumptions and prejudgments that people of Asian American and Pacific Islander populations regularly endure. Let's reinforce some basic facts, and Paul and others have already described some of these, but it bears repeating. AAPI are the fastest growing minority group in our country, currently numbering about 24 million, expected to double by 2060. Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders do not represent a homogeneous population. We are a profoundly heterogeneous population linked to more than 50 different ethnicities, 100 different languages, and roots spanning half the globe. About 2/3 are born overseas, about 1/3 have limited English proficiency, about 15% represent more than one race, and socioeconomic outcomes vary widely. So if we truly want to move toward health equity, we have to stop making assumptions and find good data to see how AAPI health outcomes compare, first externally compared to other major racial groups, but also internally with respect to inter-ethnic differences. But getting good, reliable health data on AAPI outcomes and getting quality disaggregated data by ethnic subgroup is a major, major struggle. When I started my career as a young physician years ago, I looked hard to find AAPI health data, but it was literally non-existent back then. Over the years, it's gotten better, but it's far from ideal. So the level of published rigorous research to date on AAPI health is far from optimal. In fact, a recent study noted that less than 0.2% of the NIH budget was dedicated to AAPI health research. So how should the public health and medical community respond to all this? First, we should denounce AAPI hate, routinely include AAPI issues as part of diversity and equity efforts, and push for better data, particularly disaggregated data. Second, we must understand that Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, particularly those born overseas, may not feel comfortable navigating the healthcare system, especially if they face barriers with respect to culture or language. Third, clinicians must overcome their own implicit biases and avoid making any assumptions about an AAPI patient. Don't assume anything about their ethnicity, place of birth, languages spoken or not spoken, socioeconomic position, culture, spouse, sexual orientation, or worldview. If you don't know, don't assume. Just ask. And in a time like this, acknowledging to patients of Asian American and Pacific Islander background the difficulty of discrimination compounding the challenges of the pandemic can serve as a way to signal respect and support. And that's what true patient-centered care is all about.
Thank you so much, Howard, for that. And thank you to everyone for all of your valuable, amazing insights. There's so much to unpack. I want to, again, this is the forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. We're presenting this jointly with The World from PRX and GBH. And for everyone who's tuning in, you can post your questions to the forum at hsph.harvard.edu. I also want to kick off this next part of the discussion featuring where we dig deeper, featuring a clip, a short audiogram from The World from PRX. You've talked about, you know, Asian Americans, AAPI, it's not all one monolith, but this sort of extends to the more global reach of what's happening in this moment as well. If you spend time on almost any university campus in the US, you'll likely encounter lots of students from China. Chinese students make up the largest number of international students in the US, but their numbers are dropping. And the rise in anti-Asian hate crimes and incidents may be fueling the trend. The World's Rebecca Cantor talked to some Chinese students about how these recent events are changing the way they think about the United States and themselves.
Norman Wu is a computer science student at Clark University in Massachusetts. During the pandemic, he's been living in Hangzhou and taking classes online while he waits for the travel restrictions to the US to be lifted. He says he wanted to post on Chinese social media, but didn't know if other Chinese people would understand.
Should I stand out for the so-called Asian Americans? Because, you know, I'm not American. So, yeah, I'm struggling with that.
Before he went to the US, Wu says he always thought of himself as Chinese. But after going to the US, he started to take on a new identity based on how others see him. It was awkward.
I would say in this process, you have to destroy your old identity. Like, you're no longer a Chinese, a Korean, a Vietnamese, but you are Asian. You have to be, because the racist wouldn't think you as a Chinese, a Korean, or any other thing. They just think you as an Asian.
He says taking on this Asian identity makes him feel helpless, but also powerfully connected to others in a fight against systemic discrimination.
We can connect with other community, like the Black community, the Latin community. I think we can unite together.
So as we just heard, anti-Asian violence and rhetoric in the US is challenging people's sense of belonging and identity. It's reverberating globally, but it's also making connections, bringing people together, and prompting action. And all of these dynamics impact health. Russell, I want to turn back to you in starting this conversation. I wanted to get into the mental health impacts and racial trauma, but initially just kind of in coming off of what we've just heard and this thread about how do we combat this? We've just heard Juliet talk about some of these federal and there's also state legislation to address this. And I'm thinking about how that also complements or contrasts with the kind of documentation and what you're doing with your project. And so I wanted, I've been thinking about this as these comments, as with all of your opening remarks, like what is this moving forward justice look like now? And in terms of how to address these incidents?
When we just heard Norman's clip about how he has to, the racism is complicating his own sense of Chinese identity is a real good example of the racial profiling that Asians are experiencing now. So 60% of our respondents at Stop API Hate are not necessarily Chinese, but they're people who look Chinese, right? Vietnamese, Koreans, Japanese. And so it's clear people, we're not invisible. You know, we talk about we're invisible in some ways, but we're very visible in that people see us as Asians and then get triggered. They think of us as disease carriers and we're profiled. So in that way, I think what Norman talked about, Asian Americans now have this opportunity to understand we're being racially profiled as threats. And so we could build solidarity with other groups who are also seen as threats and mass incarcerated, other people who are seen as threats and mass detained and have their family separated, other people seen as threats and mass banned because Asians have been mass banned. So I think this is a good racial moment for America to understand how do we treat those seen as other? How do we see people as threats or as insiders? And for Asian Americans, as we've been saying, the perpetual foreigner stereotype has been deadly. It's been killing us. And for Asian Americans, and in terms of mental health, we have an identity issue that stresses us. We're feeling like we're unaccepted, we don't belong, but more importantly, about that lack of belonging leads to fear for our grandparents. It's fear of our family members. So we've asked Stop API Hate respondents, what's your greatest stressor during the pandemic? And overwhelmingly and unanimously, they said racism is their greatest stressor. So think about that. Asian Americans are more concerned about other Americans' hate than they are of a pandemic that's killed 500,000 people. Asian Americans are more worried about the other American next to them than they are about a pandemic that's killed 500,000 people. That's how widespread the racism is. That's how insidious it is. That's how traumatizing it is. I can't say it enough. Asian Americans are under a state of siege at this moment. We're keeping our elderly in. Again, we're avoiding places. We're arming ourselves. We're going into fight or flight mode. We're really concerned about sending our students back to school. So I think the mental health impact over being treated so unacceptably, being treated as the other has been really harmful.
Paul, I want to get to you, but first, Juliet, like, how do you see this legislation addressing some of this and moving that forward, or what more needs to be done?
So, you know, I think so. Some of the nuts and bolts of the proposed new federal legislation really, I won't describe the details, but as a framework, what the legislation, as I interpret it, does call for a whole of government approach and commitment to addressing anti-Asian violence. And I think this is distinctively notable. We're hearing it from the White House, but the legislation calls for the Department of Justice as one example to take a more pronounced role. The Department of Justice across the federal government, it is also calling upon resources made available to state and local governments to also unity of effort, if I can call it that, with regard to addressing anti-Asian hate and incidences. With that, I think if you take that whole of government approach, both at the federal level, but in partnership with states and locals. And I know with your audience that you have a lot of policymakers who tune in, particularly at the state and local levels. I firmly believe it's at the local and state government level where we see innovation, where we can see the first steps of how can a whole of government with community partnership begin to catalyze systemic reform and break down structural barriers. For example, Howard highlighted earlier the importance, but also the lack of disaggregated data for many years, if not decades. So these types of institutional barriers, we can point to a state. My understanding is that the state of Hawaii in the last handful of months has doubled down and made the commitment to provide disaggregated data for the AANHPI community, including the Filipino community. That's a wonderful example of the power of government. But I also do think going forward, as an advocate, I'm always looking to raise the bar. This is where the mayors and the governors, the question is, how strong is your partnerships with local community groups, with faith-based leaders from our community to drive that innovation, to tackle and bring down and address those institutionalized structural barriers? I firmly believe with innovation and private-public partnership, we can tackle how we address language accessibility. In the context of COVID and the pandemic, the most important thing is getting timely and accurate information. Hmm. When the country added, I believe as an undercount, when the US society, we include 25 million Americans as limited English proficient, and one third of that 25 million is AAPI, I want to say, come on, folks, with innovation, let's address the language barrier. With innovation, let's bring about change so that we can have disaggregated data. And with partnership, I mean, this is what is so wonderful about our American society, is that when we have a unified effort, when we are collectively committed to wanting to take care of one another for the sake of inclusion, a neighbor-to-neighbor approach, I'm very optimistic that innovation can bring about change. The last point I do want to say, some of you may know that one of the, you know, I like Howard, I'm calling Howard out here. We are alums of the federal government. I proudly served at the Departments of Health and Human Services and Homeland Security and played in the civil rights space. So I will say from a civil rights lens, the failure to bring about equity, the failure to address disparities, particularly in the healthcare context, from a legal perspective, very well does amount to title violence and or national origin discrimination. So again, I'm an optimist at heart. I am looking forward to innovation. And at the same time, I will end my sentence by saying, let's look at our history of the civil rights movement. And very much, this is a civil rights issue so that our communities no longer have to face these types of disparities.
I want to turn to Paul now, who has a wonderful transition in talking about the history aspect of this as well. You spoke about this historical invisibility. Do you think that that's changing? And when you think about these kinds of innovations that Juliet speaks of, how do you see this in this historical lens? And do you see this changing?
I hope so. I think that the fact is that, and I sort of maybe did this a little hyperbolically, but I was interviewed on NPR or something a couple of weeks ago. And I told the reporter, I said that I thought that in the last 3 weeks, more Americans probably learned more about the Asian American community in the last 3 weeks than they did in the previous 100 years. And that is to say that this notion that we've been talking about here that's so familiar to all of us here, Russell talked about it from the very beginning, the notion that as soon as he heard that this was going to be the China virus, he immediately thought that this situation was going to emerge along the lines that it did. That's familiar to many of us. It's not familiar to most Americans, I think. And so to that degree, I think the invisibility, we're certainly lifting it, and I hope that that's true. But if you really think about it, I think about, for example, when my family was thrown in concentration camps in World War II. And if we had to, just think if for example, we threw in the concentration camps prominent Asian Americans in 2021, as we did in 1942, we might have to throw the Vice President of the United States into a concentration camp. We might have to throw United States senators and representatives like Judy Chu's of the world and Tammy Duckworth's of the world into a concentration camp. We might throw the manager of the world champion Los Angeles Dodgers, Brian Roberts, into a concentration camp. That visibility helps us to some degree from trying to prevent that from happening, and hopefully that we'll be able to do this. But that visibility is still not a protection completely. You know, that's a notion that these forces are powerful. It did not stop your weighing against that invisibility or visibility against the fact, for example, that the most powerful person in the world, Donald Trump, decided very clearly to make, and consciously, when he was told about these impacts, he continued to persist. And that's a strong force in the other direction. And that's why I think, for example, this is not the last we're going to hear about this. But in terms of solutions, I think, I know it sounds very nerdy and maybe self-serving, but I think it really is education. The fact is that, and Asian Americans haven't had very many opportunities to do so. My research institute is one of really only two freestanding entities within the United States really that looks at the Asian American experience. When I see what the fact that he started Stop API Hate, he did so because there was nothing that existed really there already to chronicle these things. And so we're creating things for the first time, and this creating for the first time needs support. And I give it to Russell for, I really applaud him for really understanding the need, because people are saying, where do we get this data about Asian American hate? And Russell figured it out, and he said, we don't have it. And he says he's gonna take it upon himself in a small effort, which has now become, unfortunately, a big effort. And these efforts have got to get supported, this education, because these are part of the solution. And I hope we understand that education is something that just doesn't happen. It requires support for ethnic studies, Asian American studies, part of our curriculum in the schools. We have to understand this history that I've talked about is part of our American history, not anybody, only a small group's history.
Howard, I want to turn to you and ask you about how you see this playing out in the space of healthcare, the data gaps, but also potential progress in terms of the needs of AAPI communities.
Sure, Alana. Well, first, let's look at COVID. As Juliet has mentioned, and Paul and Russell too, it's been very difficult to get reliable data at the national and state levels about AAPI COVID outcomes. So we look at official data that suggests that aggregate Asian American and Pacific Islander cases, hospitalizations, and deaths may be generally similar to that of non-Hispanic whites, but parts of the country show special burdens. One of the few peer-reviewed studies published to date cited higher death rates in some states like Nevada and Utah for reasons unknown. We're always concerned about Pacific Islander populations that make up some of the most impoverished and disadvantaged populations in our country. There's some preliminary data suggesting higher case fatality rates for Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders with COVID. That needs to be explored further, because if that's documented, it may be more evidence for reluctance to seek care. And in the midst of all this, we should remember that Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders are highly represented in the healthcare field, and that makes them susceptible, not only to COVID because of the exposure, but also susceptible to the discrimination we've been talking about. And in fact, 1 in 5 physicians and surgeons in the US are of AAPI background. And it was very interesting to see one preliminary study from a national nursing organization that found that nurses of Filipinx background, some 4% of the total US nursing workforce, may comprise over 30% of nurse fatalities. So that needs confirmation. And then more broadly, we know that the Asian American Pacific Islander population bears some special burdens related to diabetes and obesity that carries higher risk for COVID death. Immigrant men have higher rates of tobacco use. Hepatitis B remains a special challenge. And then through COVID, when so much prevention has been overlooked, contributing to excess deaths for everybody, we should be mindful that AAPI already have lower cancer screening rates than the general population, again, reflecting trust and possibly access issues. And then my last comment is with respect to health insurance coverage, until recently, Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders had lower rates of health insurance coverage compared to non-Hispanic whites. This is particularly true for Korean Americans for reasons not well understood. And trying to do something about this through the Affordable Care Act was something that Juliet and I at HHS were proud to help address in the Obama administrations, and more on that in a couple of minutes.
Well, I guess we can go to that. Juliet, if also just for everybody, Juliet's been having some kind of connectivity issues. That's why she's coming in and out. But so that's looking at, you know, some specifics around the Affordable Care Act and potential progress, but disparities and who's signing up and gaining access, what sort of progress or needs? Well, Juliet's just dropped out. Maybe Howard, you can pick this up a little bit. Do you see in that kind of progress, or Juliet, if you're able to pick that up?
Sure, I can pick it up. Yeah, thank you again. I may be turning my video off and on. It seems to help with the connectivity issues. So I think Howard really elegantly painted a broader picture, and this ties into the earlier part of our conversation for the need for disaggregated data. Whether it's our community or any other community, just to bring it down and take a step back, it's we all have limited resources, but with disaggregated data, it gives us the visibility into how well or how not well our communities are doing. And again, we've stated time and time again, we are not a monolithic community. I want to say we have the beauty of the vibrancy and the resiliency of our community, but we are incredibly diverse. But if we can take that disaggregated data and prioritize that as a need from a pragmatic standpoint, it allows us to then allocate our resources in a smarter fashion, interventions for outreach to get accurate information to discrete communities. Picking up where Howard left off, for example, we had learned that before the Affordable Care Act, 1 in 5 Koreans was uninsured. With a little bit of more curiosity and digging, and again, taking that whole of government approach, what we learned was that there was a correlation, if you will, if I can call it that, I'm not a scientist, is that a large population of the uninsured with the Korean community actually coincided with small business owners. And so then with a partnership with the Small Business Administration, we were able to hone in outreach efforts, intentional and intensified messaging. And over less than a 5-year period, we saw the uninsurance rate for Koreans drop by almost 50%. That is a pragmatic illustration of what the power of disaggregated data, the power of partnership, the need for disseminating information language. These are small investments up front that is going to make an impact when it comes to the health and well-being, not just for now, but for generations to be had. I think one more thing, if I can highlight, is when we're talking about addressing anti-Asian hate, is an understanding what our communities have faced. In this climate of an anti-immigrant agenda over the last 4 years, for example, we saw a close to a 50% drop of immigrants seeking healthcare at community health centers, just because they were scared to step out of the shadows. Mm. It's not the first time our communities have experienced this. Latino immigrant experienced this. African Americans, African immigrant communities experienced this. I'll drop in the chat box momentarily with the Department of Justice and the White House now really bolstering a desire to address anti-Asian violence, we also need to, at a family level, understand when the Department of Justice now in this new administration puts that information, and with Russell's good efforts, where we're trying to communicate to our communities, it's very important to pick up the phone and report incidences of hate. Our communities, because of our cultural background and also because of the language barriers, they are going to be fearful of stepping out and reporting that. They can, in many instances, conflate a partnership with law enforcement akin to immigration enforcement stepping out for deportation reasons. So I think those are the dynamics. I don't even want to call it nuances, but something that I wanted to uplift. And so as a result, a couple of partners, including my organization, we created a toolkit earlier this month just to try to explain the notion why for Americans we can understand why it's important to report incidences of hate, but it does speak to being able to collectively overcome those cultural and linguistic barriers. So then we have the data so that we can understand what's happening so that we can then help one another.
Thank you so much for that. I wanna move into some questions that have been coming in this last portion of our discussion. And I think a good transition from that is a question for Russell that's come in from Susan. What makes the Stop AAPI Hate Reporting Center different from hate crime reporting services that exist in the Department of Justice? Is that data shared? How is it different? And what's the impact?
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. What originally we asked for the data center to be housed in the California Attorney General's office because we figure it's government's responsibility to track and maintain the health and safety of its citizenry. That agency said they didn't have the capacity, so we created it. And it turned out to be a great choice because I think we were much more culturally responsive. We now have 12 languages where people could report. We have a high number of limited English speaking people reporting on those languages. We're adding Pacific Islander languages now. And because we're community-based, and then we actually explicitly said we will not report this data to law enforcement, I think because we were trusted community partners, our agencies have over 100 years of experience in the community, people were found us more trustworthy to report to. But we also found out is that people weren't seeking individual redress, like the way maybe mainstream Americans would want to complain for their individual rights. Our respondents were saying, we want to develop a collective voice so it won't happen again to others. Mm. And so that sort of collective mindset, we need a collective voice to be amplified. Like Julia said, we need disaggregated data to know where the racism is occurring, to whom it's happening, what the language is being used. So then we can develop specific policy interventions. Like Julia said, we need a comprehensive approach to racism. And so I think our respondents were looking for that. That's what made us different, being culturally responsive, being grounded in the community, being a trusted partner. And so I think, there's a lot of cause now for Department of Justice hotlines. And I think we should report, government should track. But at the same time, there is a real strong a strength in having community-based organizations, a civil rights infrastructure for Asian Americans, so that Asian Americans could feel like they could trust their own community to stand up for them, to speak for them, and to represent them.
This question is from Michael, and I'll put this to Paul, which is, and connecting with, as you're thinking of this moving forward, what's needed, in our government and locally, has the fuller history of racially targeted violence experienced by Asian Americans, like lethal violence, lynching, state violence, been really consistently well documented?
No, it hasn't been well documented because I think for much of our period of time, Asian Americans have then been part of the American family, if you will. If you're an immigrant from Asia, not allowed to become a citizen, you're not considered really a part of the structure. If immigrants from Asia are not allowed to come as they essentially were from the second century of the 20th century, right up till the mid part of the, really until 1965 to a considerable degree, then you're really not a part of the American family. So no, there hasn't been this documentation, certainly along the lines that Russell has talked about in terms of hate activities and so forth. But the fact of the matter is that I think while the focus on hate crimes and so forth and documenting so is key, I think the point that Russell began with, it's the small things that don't get recorded and those things are important. I'm struck, for example, in terms of the impact it has on youth. Mm-hmm. In the Boston schools last week, we returned to full-time, in-person schooling. And in a survey of parents, Asian American families, to the great surprise of a lot of people, were the most reluctant to send their kids in, and people wondered why. And in looking at that, major part of the explanation is those parents were afraid to send their kids back to schools, concerned were racist actions by bullying and so forth by their classmates. Now, whether that was going to happen or not, the concern of it, that's the sort of thing that doesn't get reported in a hate crime report. It's critical, I think, to happening to that population. You see it manifest in a variety of different ways. The stress that it has, I have colleagues who teach college who say, for example, that they think their Asian American students in their classrooms, 100% of them are being stressed by the environment within they're in. I have students who tell me, for example, that they're afraid to cough in class because they think they're going to get called out by their instructor. You know, those sorts of things are having an impact on the Asian American community at that particular level. And it's beyond the hate crimes or the shootings and so forth, which are critical. But I think this ongoing sort of impact is even greater, and particularly in terms of the mental health and so forth, those aspects of the Asian American community that have often long been neglected as well. And so I think that these impacts are the ones that are in some ways the most pernicious and the most general. And I really applaud Russell for trying to capture all of this, the full range of it, not only simply the most dramatic of them.
This question's from Mira, and maybe following up on that, in what way have the kind of stereotypes of Asian Americans, like model minority tiger mamas, somehow lessened people's empathy about racism directed at AAPI individuals? I will throw that to Juliet.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. I think my short immediate response is it's really important to treat each other as individuals and approach it from that regard. And the whole of this conversation, what we've been talking about is, you know, if we were having a conversation, you were to ask me, Juliet, where are you originally from? Actually, my response would be, I'd say Pittsburgh. And I want to share that because it's that kind of a dialogue, the willingness to engage in that fashion, again, one-on-one, to overcome this notion of being a perpetual foreigner. This label, I don't know who created the label, but it makes me very sad. I am so American, like my next fellow American. So again, I think whatever we can do collectively and individually to dispel with, really do away, acknowledge this model minority myth, but not apply model minority to us. And then also to dispel this notion of perpetual foreigner. I mean, my colleagues on the panel today have shared so many really elegant ways in how this societal hate really, really is harmful. At our core, the discrimination and the hate incidences. So again, just taking it, just have that one-on-one conversation. I will say again, having a conversation like this, if I could leave a couple of recommendations or friendly homework assignments for us collectively, you know, I would just ask you, you know, whether you're in corporate America, whether you're with the mayor's office or at the governor's office, do you have an advisory group of Asian American, Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander leaders? I think some states do that well, but I know not all 50 states do that. but it is this notion of making sure it's another construct to make sure your table is big enough that it includes our perspective and our voices from the beginning, mm-hmm. not after a crisis. And that is low hanging fruit. I know, you know, you'll add that to your list of things to do. And when we have this conversation again in 6 months or a year, I'm really looking forward to seeing how many states and governors have a commission on AAPIs, how many corporations in corporate America are willing to do that. And it's that kind of individual dialogue, but systemic recommendations where collectively we can and we must make progress.
This next question before we wrap up comes from Anna. I want to point this to Paul and to Howard. Do you see the hate incidents against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders as part of a broader phenomenon as well, as we're seeing surges in hate incidents growing in many different communities?
Yes, I do. I think, for example, to the our Latino brothers and sisters who've been focused on so much sort of discrimination, I tell them that the Asian Americans, we know we've been there before. We've been the outsiders. We've been considered the peril at the gate. We've been, you know, the notion of undocumented immigrant was invented. That term was invented for Asian Americans in 1882. So we understand their situation. To our Muslim brothers and sisters, we know what it means to be the subject of collective guilt, to be held responsible for the acts of some to be imposed on all of us. You know, we were thrown in concentration camps, my family, because of that notion. To our Black brothers and sisters, I think we know, because we have been subject to the violence and so forth. And to me, solidarity with these communities of color and these communities that have been subjected to so much is the key to not only our liberation and our addressing these issues, but to all of us. It's you know, I noticed, for example, in Ferguson, Missouri, people in support of the Darren Wilson, the person who shot a young man, an 18-year-old named Malcolm Brown, used to wear stickers that says, I am Darren Wilson, in showing their solidarity with the policeman who shot Michael Brown, the 18-year-old kid. I think for us, we gotta in some ways wear a badge that says, I am George Floyd, I am Breonna Taylor, I am Vincent Chin, I am so on and so on and so forth. And I am not a virus, I am not an undocumented, that's the basis upon which we have to understand our solidarity with all these causes, unfortunately.
Thank you so much, Paul. Howard, I wonder if you had some responses as well in thinking about as you dig into the healthcare spaces.
Well, it's hard to follow that. I really respect Paul's tremendous passion and expertise here. But it's just fair to say, from the broadest point of view, that COVID has been a major stressor for our society, every aspect of our life in this country and around the world. And it's put a glaring spotlight on all the inequities that we face as a society, whether it's health inequities or otherwise. And it's put a big spotlight on how we either work together or don't work together to overcome these challenges and try to recover and become a healthier society going forward. So I just echo everything that Paul said so beautifully.
Well, thank you to everyone. I wish we had a whole other hour to unpack so much, or maybe 2 days, I don't know, to unpack so much of these important issues, which it's the beginning of more conversations, right? But in our remaining time, in just a few minutes, I wanna wrap up by asking each of you to share with us one key takeaway to leave the discussion with. And let's do this in the same order we started, which I believe starts with Russell.
Thanks, Alana. Thanks, the world and Harvard Chan Public Health for hosting us. I said at the beginning, history repeats itself, that we be met with racist interpersonal violence and racist policies. And last year, the administration extended the Muslim ban to include Asian countries, cut Chinese scientists and researchers from migrating, cut migration visas overall so families couldn't reunite, cut refugee resettlement, cut H-1B visas. So all these policies institutionalized Asian exclusion. It was basically the second Chinese Exclusion Act. And so COVID-19 was used as a rationale to exclude Asians yet again on the basis that we're national security threats or health threats. And so that's why Asian Americans really need to work like Juliet, like Howard, like Paul, to defend our civil rights and to expand our civil rights. History repeats itself. And the last part about history repeating itself is that Asian Americans have always fought back to this discrimination. That's our legacy. We've always resisted. We've always expanded the notion of civil rights in America. We've always reconceptualized what it means to be American. And so as we enter Asian Heritage Month, I hope we can continue to remember that legacy. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Paul. Russell, moving on to Paul.
Yeah, I began by saying for 40 years, I've been giving this same talk. And so hopefully I'll be able to do a Nancy Pelosi and get my notes and rip them up and throw them away and not.
It was too much for the Zoom screen.
There you go.
Okay, well, Juliet.
Sure, I think I'm just gonna, some of my quick takeaways here is, collectively, we'll ensure there's no more invisibility for our community. Words matter, language matters, data matters. There's a need for us to get to know each other one-on-one, individually, the power of partnership. I think also the power of uplifting, even as our communities are facing this incredible surge of hate and violence. It's important to uplift our brothers and sisters in all communities of color. And then I didn't get a chance to highlight, but I do want to highlight something Russell stated earlier. It's also really important to uplift women in this time and era. There is gender-based violence. And so for all of us, let's make sure we uplift women. And also the immigrant communities that are emerging across different parts of the country, like the Midwest and in the South. And so with that, I'm just really, really grateful for our panelists, for you, Alana, and the audience, and look forward to staying in touch.
Thank you so much, Juliet. Howard?
Well, Alana, thank you so much. What a great panel, and we're so grateful to you for moderating. I want to thank Russell, Paul and Juliet for these fantastic comments. And I want to thank everybody watching because this is such a critical issue for our country right now. So as the country recovers from the pandemic, the fundamental question is, how do we achieve true health equity for all? How do we help all people reach their highest attainable standard of health? That wonderful phrase from the WHO. To me, it means understanding that we are all Americans. In times like this, we have to stand together on behalf of anyone who has ever felt bias, prejudice, and discrimination in their lives. My dear friend, the late Reverend William Sloan Coffin, liked to say, if we don't stand for something, we'll fall for anything. So we have to stand for this. And Reverend Martin Luther King once said, we may have all come over on different ships, but we're in the same boat now. And I think that's the only way to move forward.
That was Howard Koh, Harvey V. Feinberg Professor of the Practice of Public Health Leadership at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and the Harvard Kennedy School. Russell Jung, Professor of Asian American Studies at San Francisco State University and co-founder of Stop AAPI Hate. Paul Watanabe, Director of the Institute for Asian American Studies and a Professor of Political Science at the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. And Juliet Choi, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Asian and Pacific Islander American Health Forum. This panel discussion was jointly presented by the Forum at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and us here at The World. You can view the video of this conversation on our Facebook page, and you can find that at theworld.org/Facebook. And see more from the series at theworld.org/coronavirus-conversations. Thanks for listening.